Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cooker, 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. I want to thank the lovely people at Cooker for continuing to support this podcast. They're also supporting my new platform, lovejoy.co.uk, which is a health and how to navigate through life style platform, with lots of advice from all the experts that we've spoken to on this podcast. By the way, I'm not giving self-help advice myself. I'm asking the questions, and as you know, I have a lot more questions than answers. Head over there, have a read, watch some videos, let me know what you think. lovejoy.co.uk. You can email me at lovejoyhour@gmail.com. And let me know what you think or anything you want to add. Today's Lovejoy Hour is more learning for me and hopefully for you too. Today I'm curious about creating good luck, creating your own luck. And to find out about this, I'm going to be having a conversation with Dr. Christian Bush, who's got a new book out called Connect the Dots. He's an expert in entrepreneurship, social innovation and purpose-driven business. He teaches at New York University and at the London School of Economics and directs the NYU Global Economy Program. His previous book was called The Serendipity Mindset, The Art and Science of Creating Good Luck. Let's meet him. Hello, Christian.
Hey, Tim. Thanks for having me.
Absolute pleasure. You're based in New York and London at the same time, or how do you teach in both of those places?
Yeah, it's, you know, back and forth, trying to get the summers in London and then the rest of the year somewhere in the UK. But I'm always, you know, very nostalgic coming back. I used to live in London for 10 years.
Right. Well, I suppose the best way to start with this is for you to tell us a bit about yourself. So tell me about yourself, first of all. What do you actually do, and how did it work out that you ended up writing books on serendipity and luck?
Yeah, it was a very serendipitous journey in itself. I grew up in Heidelberg in Germany, where Goethe and Schiller wrote their poems, very philosophical city. I had a lot of energy that I channeled into very questionable pursuits. I was kicked out of high school, had to repeat a year, probably held the unofficial world record of how many dustbins and trash cans you can knock over on your way to school when you're driving. And then one day I wasn't so lucky anymore. I crashed into four parked cars, all cars completely destroyed, including my own. And I won't forget the policeman who came to the scene, and he was like, oh my God, he's still alive. And so that idea that I was supposed to be dead, that stuck with me. And I asked myself all these weird questions, you know, in terms of if I would have died, who would have come to my funeral, who would have actually cared, was it all worth it? And at that point, I only had depressing answers. And so it took me on this intense search for meaning. And I started reading this amazing book, highly recommended, especially in times like the ones we live in, Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, which is all about the question of how do we find meaning even in tough circumstances. And what I realized reading this book is that the way I derive meaning is connecting ideas, connecting people, and seeing the spark that comes from these kind of things that connect. And so it took me on a journey as community builder, entrepreneur, social entrepreneur, and later into academia. And what I found fascinating is in all these different areas, the most successful, purpose-driven, inspiring people, they seem to have something in common, which is that they intuitively cultivate serendipity. They see a little bit more in unexpected moments and then turn that into positive outcomes. And so I got really excited about that question. Is there a science-based framework for this? Is there a pattern that is the same when you look at the social entrepreneur somewhere in the Cape Flats in Cape Town to the CEO of XYZ company? Very different stories, but is there a pattern that we can understand and then learn from to really have more of that kind of unexpected good luck in our life?
Okay, so you've written a couple of books about this, but how did you get to do, you know, you work in entrepreneurship, social innovation. Is that in the same field?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, I first thought when I was, you know, part of building communities, building companies, that serendipity is more something that's, you know, something, a personal kind of philosophy of life and something that just happens a lot to me. But what I found fascinating is when studying entrepreneurs and social entrepreneurs around the world, that just popped up everywhere. And, you know, you would go to dinners within, you know, particular communities, and people would constantly say, my God, such a coincidence, such a coincidence, such a coincidence. And so it was fascinating to, in a way, having serendipitously emerge as a subject of study because it just happened everywhere.
Yeah, so you write in your book you were going to be writing a book. I'm trying to remember what it was. It was not that exciting, was it? Well, in my perspective, it wasn't, because it's not something that you were going to do, integrating profit and purpose. And the people you're talking to were like, have you got anything else? And you said serendipity, and everyone went, oh yeah, we can work with that. That's, yeah, again, that is serendipity that you ended up doing that, right? I suppose we should define serendipity and how you see it at this stage.
Absolutely. And that's true. This book in itself came out of this kind of serendipitous moment of, you know, wanting to write a book about exactly the things you just mentioned, right? Like, how do we develop impactful businesses and develop purpose-driven organizations? And I pitched that to friends of mine who are extremely knowledgeable, and they literally said, Christian, you know, this sounds interesting, but do you have other stuff as well? You know, it was a very clear indication that probably that idea wasn't really that interesting. And what intuitively came to mind was, wow, like, my whole life has been since that kind of moment around serendipity, and a lot of my research points into that, so why not write a book about this? And so it was serendipitous in itself. But to your point, what is serendipity actually? And you know, usually when we think about luck, we think about blind luck, right? We think about things that happen to us, being born into a loving family, things that a lot of times cause societal inequality, right? Because some people are better off than others because they had that kind of dumb blind luck happen to them. But then serendipity is about smart luck. It's about that luck that we have to work for. I mean, you know, take that quintessential moment. If, you know, imagine you're in a coffee shop and you have erratic hand movements like I do, you spill a lot of coffee. And so imagine you spill coffee over someone, and, you know, they look at you slightly annoyedly, but you sense there might be something there. You don't know what it is. You just sense there might be something there. And now you have two options, right? Option number one is you just say, I'm so sorry. Here's a napkin. You walk outside and you think, ah, what could have happened had I spoken with that person? Option number two, you know, you start a conversation and that person ends up to become the love of your life, your co-founder, your business partner, you name it. The point is our reaction to the unexpected, our making the accident meaningful, is what serendipity is about. And so when you trace back serendipity in your own lives, I bet there's always this kind of active element of having to go on another date, having to do something with that moment, and really kind of a lot of times also needing that tenacity, because serendipity, a lot of times, you know, you might have read something in a book 10 years ago, and then now you bump into someone who tells you about something, and you might be like, oh my God, such a coincidence. I thought about this 10 years ago, but now it's time for the podcast that I always wanted to, right? So those kind of things where it's about saying, how do we leverage the unexpected and turn it into positive outcomes?
So do you believe in luck, or do you think it's your perception which creates luck?
You know, it's interesting. I've always been a big fan of these experiments that in a way try to figure out, do people who believe that they are lucky turn out to be luckier? And so one experiment in the UK, which was a bit more of a fun kind of experiment, but it has in similar ways been replicated in different situations. They take a person, and you know, I'd love to ask every listener, like, do you consider yourself to be lucky or unlucky when we talk about this now? Because it will actually shape a lot of your life going forward. And the reason that is in this experiment, they took people who self-identify as very lucky, and then people who self-identify as very unlucky. And then they take one of each and they say, walk down the street, go into a coffee shop, grab a coffee, sit down, and then we'll have our conversation. What they don't tell them is that there's hidden cameras along the street and inside the coffee shop. In front of the coffee shop, there's a £5 note, so money. And inside the coffee shop, the seat that's empty is next to this extremely successful businessman who can make big ideas happen. Now, the lucky person walks down the street, sees the £5 note, picks it up, goes inside the shop, orders the coffee, sits next to the businessman, they have a conversation, exchange business cards, potential opportunity, we don't know that coming out of it, we don't know that part. Now, the unlucky person walks down the street, steps over the £5 note, so doesn't see it, goes inside the shop, orders a coffee, sits next to the businessman, ignores the businessman, that's it. Now, at the end of the day, they ask both people, how was your day today? And so the lucky person says, it was amazing. I found money in the street, made new friends, and, you know, potentially an opportunity coming out of it. We don't know that part. Now, the unlucky person just says, well, nothing really happened. And we see that a lot in different situations where you can put people into exactly the same situation, but the way of how they look at the world, how they perceive the world, you know, shapes a lot of this. And the reason, of course, is A, because we are more alert to things that we expect, right? If you don't expect to find money in the street, you will never find it. I find, you know, it's incredible how much money people drop in the street. I actually find a lot of, unfortunately, mostly pennies and not big money, but there's a lot of money in the streets. But also then the second part, I think, and we might talk later about this also, is of course it helps to, you know, talk with people. So there's this kind of extroversion part of it. But you know, for closet introverts like myself, a lot of times serendipity comes out of quiet sources, right? Watching a movie and thinking, oh my God, this could be a podcast. Or taking another street to work and then thinking, when looking to the bookstore and seeing that title, oh my God, this could be, you know, a Netflix movie that we should do. Whatever it is, like, the idea is that we can create that smart luck by being alert and doing a couple of other things that I'm sure we'll talk
about.
Hold
on, you're saying you're an introvert.
an extroverted introvert in the sense of, you know, being no problem speaking in front of a couple of hundred people and then hiding in the restroom afterwards because I need to replenish and build the energy.
Yeah,
back.
See, I'm sorry about this, but I'm just not convinced on the extrovert introvert thing that we're being, because I read your book and you know, when you were a kid at school, you were busy on the phone trying to do business. I wasn't doing anything at school. I just couldn't be bothered. You know, I don't think that's, you're one of these, you know, you're putting yourself up and lecturing, you're writing books, you're willing to come on podcasts. That doesn't seem to me to be someone who's an introvert. And as you read through your book, there's so many different positions you put yourself in, which creates your luck. So is that really an introvert? How are you defining introvert?
You know, it's fascinating because I had that conversation recently with community builders. A lot of community builders are fascinatingly introverts. So they are people who get, you know, whom it costs energy a lot of times to be with people, versus an extrovert who takes a lot of energy with being around with people. And what I found fascinating is a lot of these community builders are extremely introvert. But then somehow we forced ourselves to be more extrovert because we know it's a world that has been designed for extroverts, right? Go to any conference you can think of. Usually it's designed for extroverts, right? It's designed for interaction and everything else, versus the kind of more calm spaces that help people have the more reflective incidences. And so in my case, you know, I a lot of times had to try to find a way to say, you know what? This is out of my comfort zone. Calling people and doing these kind of trades that you mentioned or other things, it always felt slightly uncomfortable, but it was also something where I was like, you know what, I'm so excited about this, I really want to do this now. And so I think that's kind of something, it's fascinating you say that, right? Because I think a lot of times, I've had that also with a lot of people who are, for example, you know, moderating, like being that TV, radio, whatever it is, that they seem extremely extrovert, but actually they're really introvert. And so they have this spike of extroversion where they're like all out there. And then afterwards, they're kind of like hiding at home, like, oh my God, don't let the world come to me now. So it's fascinating to have that dynamic,
yeah,
I guess.
But I wonder if we're all on a spectrum of everything. You know, I wonder if that's where we're at. And because my regular listeners know I had or have depression. And when that happens, I go very introverted because I just can't face anything. And when I feel good, I suppose people would say I'm extroverted because I'm on TV. I'm always the guy in the coffee shop talking to people. I'll talk to anyone, you know, if I think that's, I don't know, I just quite like striking up conversation with people. I find humans fascinating. Kind of the meaning of life is connecting with humans. And that's, I'm not quite sure that, you know, I think everyone struggles to put themselves out there a bit, don't they? There might be some people out there who never struggle, but I think everybody does to a certain degree. Look, let's just go back one stage though, because that Richard Wiseman experiment, the one where I think it was Richard Wiseman experiment, isn't it? The one going to the coffee shop. Is that, have I got that right?
Yeah. Yes.
What's interesting about that is we seem to be in a world at the moment. When I grew up, there was this amazing thing where people were talking about flying cars and, you know, everything was exciting. The world looked really beautiful. We were going to leave the planet and we were, you know, we'd gone to the moon and, you know, a few years before that. And yeah, it was a very exciting world and very optimistic, I think, you know, obviously. Now, I wonder if we've created an environment in the world, especially let's look at America and Britain, where, you know, I'm in Britain, you're in America, but you go between the two. where the population's very negative in their views on the world. I wonder if that has a problem with weather luck, where, you know, there seems to be a lot of darkness around in everybody's aspects with what they feel about politics and their environment and their society. Do you think that's the case?
I think you know, also to your previous point, I think that's a great point, right? That we're all somehow on a continuum of introversion, extroversion, but also more importantly, we all have some kind of self-limiting beliefs or things that we all want to work on, right? So, I mean, I certainly have an inner imposter sitting there all the time. I certainly, you know, had to overcome fear of rejection and working on those kind of themes. So I'm actually with you completely that we shouldn't just put it to some kind of traits and then say, oh my God, like this is a God-given a trait that we have. But actually that a lot of times there are things that we have to work through and sometimes they are tough and sometimes they're less tough. In my case, it's been a lot around fear of rejection and then thinking about what is it actually the worst thing that can happen when you are in this coffee shop or at a conference where you go to this speaker or to this person that you feel there could be something. Is the worst thing really the sting of rejection? Is it this kind of like feeling that really is like, oh my God? Or is it going outside in this nagging feeling of, ah, what could have happened had I spoken with this? And I realized, and what I reframed for myself is the worst thing not being the sting of rejection, but the worst thing being the nagging feeling of thinking what could have happened had I done X, Y, Z. And so I think to your point, like, I think there's a lot of dynamics around how do we also overcome our self-limiting beliefs. But then I think that's very separate from also to your point that I think there's mental health questions that I think I'm certainly not qualified to talk about, but that I think, you know, when I've seen people around me, that I've always felt that there's kind of this some of the most creative people around me have seen a lot of darkness, but then also that has given them an amazing light. And so it's kind of it's been fascinating to see those dynamics. But again, that's not an area, I think that's probably an area that you can you know, and have spoken more than I could. But I think to your other question, sorry, you were saying.
Well, no, I was just going to say that, but what my worry is at the moment is that there's a tremendous amount of negativity created by the internet and 24-hour news. That is how they sell it. That's how they get the clips. And I wonder if that is leaking into our world and that the young, especially the younger demographics of America, Britain, those sort of countries have a very negative outlook. And with that negative perspective, you then end up being unlucky.
That's a fascinating question because, you know, if you look at the kind of generations that are, you know, growing up, they grew up with climate change, with terrorism, with a lot of dark things that in a way are very existential, right? And now we just again had a collective near-death experience, right? Where we all, in a way, had to question a lot of the assumptions we all had, right? I always assumed that my newborn would be able to see her grandparents like within, you know, 2-3 months. Not possible because the borders were just closed. And so it's kind of fascinating in a way to also think about what is the kind of context within which people grow up and how they're being then developing their mindset. But on the other side, and Tim, that's why I'm so excited about this work, you know, in the spirit of Bill Drayton, the gentleman who came up with the, you know, idea of how do we scale social entrepreneurship, how do we think about social entrepreneurship differently, we need more change makers. We need more people now than ever who somehow can inspire other people to truly create their own luck. And a lot of my work is in extreme resource-constrained environments. It's in the Cape Flats of Cape Town. It's in Kibera. And, you know, those people are the people who really face the big challenges. Those are the people who every day someone, you know, in their context dies. Every day they could something tremendously bad happen. And, you know, those people, what I've found fascinating is how much we can learn around the reframing question of, okay, if you are in this tough context, is there still some kind of meaning in there that we can, you know, do something with it? And that's why actually, you know, the Viktor Frankl piece we talked about at the beginning meets this kind of research and this work, because Viktor Frankl was in the toughest environment you can imagine. He was in a concentration camp. There's no worse context than being in a setting where you know you might die every day. Like there's no way out. And he essentially said, look, objectively, there's no meaning here. There's no meaning. so I have to create a meaning. And so what he did was he said, look, every day I'll still try to talk with people in the camp to make them feel better about themselves. And by doing this, it gives me more meaning now. Now I have a reason to wake up tomorrow morning. And I think that's something I've seen a lot during COVID also, that yes, like there's a lot of distress happening. I had a very severe form of COVID. People around me had very severe forms, unfortunately, as well. But I think what was fascinating is to see how then small things such as giving the neighbor a little bit of food when they can't go outside themselves into the supermarket because they're 90 years old and don't dare to go to the supermarket. Those kind of small gestures then give us a reason again to wake up in the morning. And so my point, I guess, is that question of even in the toughest of circumstances, is there something we can do to imbue meaning in this?
Christian, we're going to get the sound right in a minute, but now your microphone's banging against your wire. Could you just move your microphone slightly away from that wire because it's banging? There you go.
Okay.
Yeah, just put it under. That's it. That's it. Perfect.
Sorry.
No, it's good. It's good. We just got to get it right. Otherwise, it'll annoy the listeners, won't it? So just give us an example, though, of some of the work you're doing. There's a bit in the book where you discuss that, you know, people are getting handouts, and that when you're getting handouts, it reflects back into the community that you're, well, you explain it.
Yeah. You know, it's really based on, so I started working in sub-Saharan Africa around 10 years ago, and spent a lot of times in countries like Kenya. And I will never forget the first time I went over and I came into the context and I said, look, what is the one thing I should never ask you? And what one of my now collaborators there told me is, Christian, never ask me first what I need. Because if you ask me what I need as a first question, you put me into the role of the victim or the beneficiary of someone who needs your benevolence versus actually saying, hey, what's already here and how can we do something together, which puts us on the same level so that then we can still work around resources and everything else. And, you know, that's really a bigger mindset question. And that's why, to that point earlier, I think we can learn a lot from those contexts, especially one organization that I've been extremely interested in is called Reconstructed Living Labs. And so that organization, they come out of the Cape Flats in Cape Town, you know, people who, it's a very crime-ridden, tough community to grow up in. And they said, you know what? The one thing we have here is resourcefulness, ingenuity. So how do we leverage this? And so what they did was they came up with a very simple education methodology. You know, things such as 10 steps to use social media to build your business. And then they take that methodology and go into other contexts and try to figure out who here could take that methodology and train other people in it. And what's so exceptional about what they do is that when they go into a new context, instead of asking what do you need or what resources do we need, they ask what's already here and how do we make the best out of this. There's an old garage, fantastic, that could be a potential training center. There's a former drug dealer, fantastic. That person is probably very resourceful, very creative, has a lot of social capital. So if we can turn them into a teacher, it becomes cool now to, you know, go into education. And so it's really rethinking about the resources that they have. And so one way they do that is via a simple budget approach. If you would go to them and say, you know, you're a local hospice that wants to integrate that training program into their services, it would be something like, okay, if you want to organize an event with 10 chairs and you tell us you need 10 chairs, first question, do you really need these chairs? Second question is, if you really need those chairs, can you get them from around here? Maybe the restaurant next door is closed at that time when you have your event, so can you get it? And only if you really, really, really need it, then you get the budget. And they've taken that approach into companies around the world, for example, where if you're a bank, right, or now during COVID, a lot of organizations, the kind of first reflex is, let's cut costs and fire people, right? That's always the kind of easy way out for a lot of managers, versus actually saying, okay, if we have this cashier who we don't need anymore, quote unquote, because now we have an ATM machine, maybe they could be a financial trainer, and maybe this old office space could be the studio for taping the financial training sessions. The point is, we can rethink every resource and everyone around us to think about what is the potentiality in that. And that's where serendipity comes out of it, because then you're looking at resources differently. The garage becomes a training center and you name it.
Mm. So I suppose there's two different things here. One is the individual, and what you're saying is it's life is about, as I understand it, life is about perception and how you're perceiving it. And if you say, just for instance, you, as you said, mentioned earlier, you perceive yourself as a lucky person, you're walking around with your eyes open, you're looking for connections, you're seeing things, and then you feel like you're getting opportunities. If you feel you're an unlucky person, you've got your head down, you feel miserable. But then you throw into that equation, so we can get onto that in a minute, how you can achieve that. But you throw into that equation, then what you're letting into your body or into your mind. And then often we've got, I'm sort of going back to a point I made earlier here, you've often got things like politics or information, the internet, or religion or society of any sort. They're telling you what to do. Now, I know a lot of times, like when I wanted to go, a very good example, when I wanted to work in television, everybody told me people like us don't work in TV. It annoyed the hell out of me and it motivated me. But I'm not alone in that, because every single group of people, whatever group you class yourself as, whatever identity you are, people set your limits for you. And that, whether that comes from governments, religion, society, whatever it is, people are setting your limits for you, aren't they? And I think that's where we have to be careful. As the groups looking in, we have to be careful what message we're sending people. But also as individuals, we've got to be careful what message is being sent into us. Am I right in that thinking?
Absolutely. And I think the way I've been thinking about exactly that question is, I feel there's objective things, right? Such as there's structural constraints, right? If you're being born in Kibera, an impoverished area in Africa, versus me here in New York in the West Village, we have very different starting positions. Objectively, my likelihood to have serendipity happen is far higher than of that person who's born in Kibera. So I think we have objectively very different starting positions, very different kind of dynamics around us and so on. And I think while we work on mindset, we always want to work on those kind of structural and societal dynamics and really think about policy. And that's another part of our work, actually. But the more important part to yours is that within any kind of context that we've been studying, there's always people who do things a little bit differently than others. And that's the kind of fascinating thing around what we talked about, of how do these people do that, and how do they selectively listen to some of the things that you just mentioned, right? So selectively listen to the kind of constraints that are more socially constructed than not, right? That in a way people tell us that XYZ is not possible. And I think, Tim, both of us lived a life, right, where we've constantly questioned, is that possible or is that not possible? And constantly just kind of say, yeah, you're telling me this, but do I believe you this? Well, let's see if maybe there's still something I can do. And I think, to your point, that's how you landed in your line of work. That's how I landed in my line of work. And to be honest with you, one of the reasons I was kicked out of high school when I was younger was exactly this, that I felt there was not a structure to channel my energy, because everyone said, like, you have to learn exactly this physics and this maths and this biology in order to be successful. And somehow I didn't want to believe that. I still don't believe it, to be honest. And we can probably have another conversation about the education system at some point. But I think the reason I love entrepreneurship is that it's about questioning those constraints. And it's about questioning especially resource constraints and other type of things, and saying, this thing, the only reason this thing is here because someone thought about it at that point, it doesn't mean that person knew what they were talking about. And as Oliver Burkeman so beautifully said, we're all just winging it. So just because someone wung it before and said this is the way, it doesn't mean that that's the truth or the one way to go.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, it used to frustrate the hell out of me when people used to tell me the way to do things. And I used to say, the thing I did with trying to work in TV, and I've really got no right to be working in TV, and a lot of people will say I shouldn't be on it anyway, but the thing was, I was like, someone's got to do the job, why can't it be me? You know, someone's got to do this stuff. What interests me about what you said just now, though, is you said because you live in New York, you have more opportunity, or you're more likely to have serendipity than someone else. I suppose that's only if you're judging on success financially or career-wise or something, or opportunities to travel the world or something, because it can come, as you mentioned, the guy in the concentration camp, you can find it in, I imagine, in any little way if you're willing to look.
Well, that's a great point, right? It reminds me of all those kind of studies where they show that people in poverty a lot of times are happier than the kind of billionaire next door who kind of, you know, is extremely unhappy because of the way someone frames the situation, right? And the way you can, you know, and again, I think that objectively we always want to tackle poverty, and I think that's extremely important. And at the same time, I think a lot of times what from the outside seems really bad, actually in the inside, you know, someone might have found a way to imbue meaning in what they're doing. And I think one thing we see a lot in our work is the joyfulness that I've seen in contexts where people are objectively poorer than, you know, I am here, but so much happier than kind of like the people who live around the corner here. I've always found that fascinating. And so I think it's really to your point, right? There's an objective situation that we should always work on because it's kind of like, it's the right thing to do. It's a moral imperative. And then at the same time, to your point, we can never assume that actually someone is happier just because they have more of X, Y, Z thing. And I think to your point, what I think is interesting though, when you think about the kind of, you know, serendipity is about potentiality, right? It's about what could be. And you're right that in every context, there's we can increase that kind of what could be, right? Like you can do that in the Cape Flats as much as here. But because it depends so much on the kind of networks we're in, it depends so much on the kind of opportunities that people can bring us, but also, you know, the kind of things that we can imagine because we have seen them, because we have had exposure to them. There is a certain propensity that is very different, I guess, in some contexts than others. But I think, to your point, it doesn't mean that you get happier because of having that. Actually, quite the opposite. Sometimes you might almost have this kind of, dilemma of choice where you're like, oh my God, I have so much potentiality now that I actually get unhappy because there's too much of it.
Yeah, yeah. Also, it can lead you down a path where you think you've been lucky. I always say the people who win don't necessarily win. There's so many cases of sportsmen who win the award, you know, the great trophy. They win it and then they are so depressed afterwards because they don't know what to do with their time after that, or, you know, so many different versions of that. But the loser ends up being very happy and has an amazing time and a really good career, you know. So you don't always win and win. You can sometimes win and lose, I think. I'm interested, though. I do a lot of these podcasts talking to people like you, and I'm fascinated by it and I'm learning so much. My worry we've got at the moment is there's a new religion which has hit, and why I like your book is you're explaining what luck is, and it's basically opening your eyes to opportunities, being aware, you know, really trying to just sort of see connections happening and you know, put yourself out there a bit and, you know, start looking at something. There's a very good example of you say that the people who invented Viagra, it was a mistake. They were trying to do something else. They saw this reaction rather than get embarrassed about it. They thought, hold on a second, there's something in this. They were open. They were aware of it. Tell that story quickly before I go on to my point.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, it's a great example, especially if you think about that, up to 50% of innovations and inventions are serendipitous like that, right? Where in this example, you know, they were giving people medication for angina pectoris, the illness, and they realized there was some kind of unexpected movement happening in male participants' trousers. And to your point, what would we usually do? We would say, oh my God, this is embarrassing. Like, let's either ignore it or let's find a quote-unquote better way, right, without the quote-unquote side effect to make that happen. They did the opposite. They said, you know what, that's very unexpected, but there's probably a lot of men in the world who might have a problem in that department, so why don't we develop it into a medication? And that's the interesting thing, right? That comes really back to the reframing point in terms of how do you make the accident meaningful? How do you see something in that moment, connect the dots to something meaningful?
Right, so we've got lots of smart people like you who are looking at the science and the research and doing that. There's a lot of people out there at the moment who are dealing in magic, and I wonder if you've got an opinion on this. There's this big thing which is happening, and it's been happening. It's a sort of, I always say it's like a new religion, and they sum it up. They always use the word universe, and they always talk about the law of attraction. And it's like you can sit in your bedroom basically, and you can magic up anything you want. And what I love about your book is like, no, you can't. What you have to do is you have to go out there and live the world, connect with people, connect with humans, be aware, open your eyes, see things, and just be open to the world. But there's a lot of this happening at the moment where people are saying, look, you just got to wish it through. Now, James Doty, who I've had on this podcast, who you possibly know, he's written a great book called Into the Magic Shop. You know, he puts the science behind it as well. And he says, look, if you're thinking about something enough, you know, if you want to be a doctor, you've got to imagine yourself being a doctor to actually get to that place. You know, you want to be a TV presenter, you've got to try and visualize being a TV presenter. But that's been changed into a new version where people stand on the stage in front of tens of thousands of people making a fortune going, if you just put it out in the universe, it will come to you. And it's just, I just think it kind of feels like nonsense magic to me. Well, do you have any views on that, Christian?
Yeah. No, I think that's a really important point. And you know, one thing I've always been fascinated by when it comes to topics like serendipity is there's both an art and a science, right? There's the kind of art where all of us have had those serendipitous moments, and sometimes they do feel magical, right? Sometimes they do feel, oh my God, like this is something that I couldn't, you know, have imagined. But to your point, I think at the core of our work is the science of it and really trying to understand what is it behind it. And when you think about the science of it, because serendipity is so much about exactly what you mentioned in terms of the Viagra example, where you connect the dots, you see something in the unexpected and then connect it to something relevant and meaningful, that's easier when you have a certain sense of direction, right? That's easier when you have a certain idea of where you're going. So to your point, when you have a certain idea of, I would love to end up in TV presenting, now it's easier for you to overhear this unexpected conversation in the coffee shop where someone talks about that they're hiring 5 people at ITV and oh my God, such a coincidence, that could be me, right? Like it's more likely that you listen to these kind of things and are alert to these things if you have some kind of sense of where you're going. And so actually, I'm a big fan of doing a serendipity journal where you write down, you know, what are the kind of, it doesn't have to be a very clear passion or purpose. I think a lot of times, you know, that's very hard to define. And I work a lot with young people. I think especially for young people, telling them, find your passion, like that's a lot of anxiety that you push right on those kids. But rather saying, hey, like what are the key interest areas you have at the moment? What are your key curiosities, right? I'd love to learn more about how TV presenting could be. Great. So that's one interest area of yours now. And now that helps you to, when you go out there, like connect the dots to that. And, you know, one of the strategies there actually that I've found very useful is the hook strategy, where the hook strategy is really about saying, when you have these key themes, these key areas that you're interested in, how do you now cast a couple of hooks so that other people can connect the dots for you? So, you know, take Ollie Barrett, who's an amazing entrepreneur in London. If you would ask Ollie, what do you do? You know, this dreaded question that we all get asked at a conference or wherever you go, he wouldn't just say, I'm a technology entrepreneur. He would say, I'm a technology entrepreneur, recently read into the philosophy of science, but what I'm really excited about is playing the piano. So what he did here is he's giving you 3 potential hooks where you could be like, oh my God, such a coincidence. My sister is teaching on the philosophy of science. You should come in as a guest speaker. Oh my God, such a coincidence. I'm hosting piano matinees. You should stop by. But the point really is that we can cast these hooks, and by doing this, make it more likely that, to your point, these kind of, you know, ideas of what we want to do become more likely to happen, even if we don't exactly know when and how that will do.
Yeah, I don't know if you've ever heard of someone called Fiona Murden. She's written a book called Mirror Thinking, and I think this is it's a really important bit to add into the equation, is when, like the stuff you were talking about there, when you're a kid, the way you learn is by watching your parents. If you want to learn tennis, the best way to do it is watch other people play tennis. But she also goes on in her book to explain, and she does it all through experiments and science, like you know, like all the good books. And she sort of, the bit I always remember is, if you want to be rich, hang out with rich people, don't hang out with poor people, because you've got much more chance of being rich if you hang out with rich people. And that is, you know, as soon as I could, I started going into, like, just giving myself an example here, because I don't come from a TV background. My family aren't, but I decided I was going to work in it. I just decided to start working for free in TV companies everywhere. When you start working in the environment, you start learning about the environment, then you're getting yourself more prepared for when an opportunity does come along. So the two things there is, you've got to be very careful about who you choose to be around, especially if you're a young person. If you hang around all the dropout, loser, you know, people who are negative, hate their lives, you'll end up reflecting that, because that's what you mirror in. But it's to learn to find the positives to mirror, but also to avoid the negatives, the people who say you can't do it, and those sort of people. That there's some truth in this, isn't there, Christian?
Well, and that's probably at the core of you know, the kind of effective ways that everyone can take literally tomorrow morning when waking up, right? Which is really thinking about what are the kind of communities I want to be part of, right? And who are the kind of people I want to surround myself with? And I think we've all had, you know, toxic people in our lives, right? So people where you know that they will kind of drag you down and they're obviously, you know, I'm a big fan, and we can probably talk about this in a second, of seeing if we can still, you know, be part of their journey in terms of having them try a couple of exercises to have a bit more serendipity, which sometimes then helps them uplift themselves a little bit more. But if that's not possible, I think kind of shifting the context and really trying to figure out where is it that I can connect with people that are in the areas that I'm interested in, but more importantly also that energetically, right, in a very non-spiritual sense, energetically are aligned. Because we all know this situation, right? Imagine you're sitting in the library, you're working on a term paper or whatever you do, and you have this kind of person next to you who's kind of like good energy, work on their thing and da-da-da-da, versus the other person who's kind of like sitting there is like, you know, like yawning around and stuff. I mean, imagine where you will be more productive and energetic, right? And so that's the same in our own lives, to your point. The kind of person we surround ourselves by, that's the person who inspires us or drags us down. That's the person who energetically gives us what we need or not. And so I'm actually a really big fan of being really conscious of the kind of communities and people we surround ourselves with, both for exactly the aspects you mentioned, right, in terms of the mirroring and everything else, and also then all these other parts, right, the energetic parts and so that really have a huge influence. And as they, you know, say similar to what you mentioned, if you want to be lucky, surround yourself with lucky people.
Yeah, Christian, I was walking down the road the other day and there was this woman on the phone and she was really heated. She was talking to someone else and I was listening to her and she goes, it's so bad. She goes, but as my dad has always told me from a young age, they're all out to get you. And I thought, what a terrible lesson. So you spend the whole of your life as a child thinking everybody's out to get you. No wonder this conversation, she's having a bad conversation, because if her dad had said that every turn is an opportunity, she'd be going to the person, yeah, it's not worked out, but it's opened my eyes to something better out there, whereas it was completely the opposite round. I think we've got to be really careful as parents, the messages we feed into our children. And sometimes that can be a problem, isn't it? You talk about surrounding yourself with nice people, but sometimes you can be trapped into a bad family or a bad community or a bad set of friends. You've got to look at that and go, I need to untrap myself, is there such a word?
Absolutely. And Tim, to your point, right, that's the same in our love relationships, for example. I mean, imagine, you know, I feel like one of the biggest lessons that I've had to learn the hard way was that when someone says, for example, when someone gets really angry about you leaving the toothpaste somewhere, it's never about the toothpaste, right? It's never about, you know, like, it's about the underlying idea that, hey, this is disrespectful, that I told you this and you're still not doing it. And now, for me, if I just react to this idea that someone tells me and gets really angry that my toothpaste was somewhere and if I push back, then we will always have a conflict. Versus if I assume positive intention and if I assume there's probably something behind that, that the person kind of, that brought some pain to the person, then it allows me to dive a little bit deeper. And I think, Tim, to your point, like if my idea of the world is that everyone's out there to get me, that everyone has negative intention and so on, it's almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy in a, again, very non-spiritual way, because it's kind of like you get what you expect, right? Like if I then think, oh, this person, they get angry about every small thing, then yes, they will get angry about every small thing, because every small thing now represents the disrespect. Versus if I just say, hey, look, like, what is behind that? Oh, I understand. Okay, that's fine. Because I assumed, hey, look, this other person's actually a pretty decent person, so I'm sure they have a reason for it. And Tim, that actually brings us to, I think, one of the most like interesting things that we've seen in our research is really the most successful, interesting, inspiring people, they have in common that they ask why all the time. They try to understand what is behind something. Why are you angry? Why are you sad? Why are you this? Versus just reacting to that moment of anger or whatever it is in that moment. And I feel, to me, that's been a game changer to really try that, to always wonder, why is that person? Is that happening? Because a lot of times, obviously, when someone is angry or in pain, like it's a reflection of themselves versus of the person they correspond with at that point in time.
Depression's a complicated beast, too hard to get into now, but I will say, when you are in depression, and probably some of my listeners will be able to confirm, your thought processes are very negative. and it's, you spiral down, and the opportunities or everything is always negative towards you, and that's how you perceive life. And one of the ways that when I go into depression now, I come out of it very quickly, in days, rather than weeks and months, which it used to be. And it's generally, I can see the thought processes starting to happen, and I'm laughing because it's like so clear now how the negativity starts spiraling down. It's the stuff you're alluding to there of thinking everyone's against me and everything's against me, and you know, everything's black, not white, everything's dark, you know, every time you look around a corner it all feels very dark. So let's talk about love, because that's interesting, because that's the one thing that people talk about all the time, isn't it, when you're trying to find a partner. And you know, if you're a single person listening to this, and all your friends will say, if you stop trying then they'll just come to you and things like that. Is there luck involved in finding the right partner for life?
Well, I mean, you know, I met the love of my life serendipitously. So I met my previous girlfriends usually serendipitously. So, you know, being in a Starbucks and quote unquote watching each other's laptops when one is on the toilet, and then starting a conversation, and then you end up. So you know, I feel a lot of times when people reflect about their love stories, there's a lot of serendipity to it, right? In terms of there's a lot to it. But as we talked about before, I think what's the really interesting thing is that when you really sit down and really think about and reflect on how did that happen, it wasn't just that kind of blind luck, right? It wasn't just that you bumped into that person in the coffee shop, but there was some kind of active part to it. And I think, to me, that's actually and why I'm such a big fan also of these serendipity journals, is when you're sitting down and try to deconstruct those things that brought you some kind of good luck, being that in love or in other areas, and really thinking about what was it that I did that led to that, right? Did I have a particular question I asked, like, and that seems to go really well, or what is it that really works well, and then doing more of that. But also, and I think, Tim, that's really, I feel, at the core a lot of times, because, you know, there's only so much one can do with practices and exercises, but the deeper theme a lot of times is, I think, more what holds us back from that, right? So when we reflect on when it could have happened, but it didn't, right? Those incidences where in the Starbucks there was this accident, but this coffee spill, but you didn't talk with the person or didn't talk with XYZ. Why is that the case? And really reflecting on what is usually the pattern behind this? Is it fear of rejection? Is it imposter syndrome? Whatever it is. And then really working on that bigger psychological question, because I think we all miss serendipity all the time because of those kind of things where even in a meeting, right, you have this unexpected idea and you don't raise it because you're like, oh, I'm not ready, I'm not, you know, whatever it is. And so it's really kind of, I've been fascinated by this, how often we miss love, we miss other types of things because we hold ourselves back.
Do you think the birth of the dating app is ruining it for people? Because everyone's always got a good story about how they met their partner until you go on a dating app, and it's kind of, then you aren't you then searching for the serendipity? But it was on our first date that they said that their mum was called and it was the same name as my mum, and that's when we realized. I mean, that's the sort of thing you hear now, isn't it? Is the dating app ruined the game of love luck?
Well, you know, it's interesting because there's an equivalent to this that I've actually been a big fan of, which is, I mean, the way I think about it is, it's almost like you're trying to create as many water cooler moments as possible, right? Like unexpected encounters of people where like, oh my God, like this could be something. And you know, I when I look at dating apps and things, I just think about it like, look, it's just a technology, right? It's about what we do with it. Like, it's just kind of, you know, I'm sure there's amazing stories of people who met via a dating app, and then the first time they met in person, they were like, oh my God, what a freak. And then again, they kind of got into something nice. So my point is, I guess there can be beautiful stories with or without technology. But actually, I think to your larger point, what I found fascinating over the last years is how much technology has allowed us to have more of these water cooler moments happen across different areas in life. And one that I'm really excited about is this whole idea of virtual coffee trials, where essentially the idea is, when you're in an organization, and you know, especially with COVID, everyone being home, not having these bumping into each other moments, especially with the boss of your boss who comes up with a new opportunity or you name it, that then essentially the idea is, everyone within a company gives one or two times when they're free, And then they get randomly matched with someone else within the company and, you know, with an inspiring prompt. You know, what is it that, you know, what's your challenge at the moment? How can I help? Whatever it is. And what that does is that people every week now, again, can reconnect with other people beyond their kind of five people that they correspond with every day, but also kind of recreate that serendipity. And the reason I'm saying this is that I think, you know, COVID and so has taken a lot from us, this kind of, you know, the human touch and the kind of interaction, but also, you know, Zoom and WebEx and so on are also, they have become our own personal private plane, right? I can be now in your what looks like an exercise room or living room, and I don't have to go through customs. I don't have to, like, you know, fly over for 5 hours. Of course, I would have done that for you, but still, like, now I didn't have to, right? And so, how convenient is it that we have that as well? And so, I think it comes to how do we use it, how do we frame it, what do we do with technology, and technology just being a tool, but it's up to us what we do with it.
Bruce Daisley was on this podcast. He's the CEO of was the European CEO of Twitter. I'm not sure he's still there now, but he writes a lot about workplaces and stuff, and one of the examples he gives of a good thing to do is they used to do, I think it was a crisp tasting thing weekly, where they'd make a chart of them or something like that. But what it did is it gave the lowest member of the team the same status and standing, because it's an opinion on a crisp, as the boss. And so it leveled people out on one sort of task per day, and that enabled the people at the bottom to feel more comfortable delivering ideas. And yeah, so I suppose what they're doing is they're creating the serendipity by creating the environment where the younger member of a team could actually do something which is beneficial to everybody. Whereas if you've just got an old school style hierarchy, it's a lot tougher for the lower member of the team to talk to the boss at the top. So I suppose that's a good idea of one of those things.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It actually also, it reminds me of this, of Pixar, you know, they do this Finding Nemo and all these beautiful, I mean, it's been one of the most creative companies in the world for a very long time. And one of the things the founders did at the beginning, they would always say, they would open a meeting and say, at the beginning, all of our ideas are bad. Okay, let's start. And so the idea is you give people the license to come up with bad ideas and to not have that self-censoring going on, right? And so to your point, especially younger people, less senior people then feel empowered to actually talk about it. And Tim, I think when it comes to serendipity, that's really also the interesting thing. To me, the biggest question always is, how do we give people the license to have more serendipity? Because look, if you're in a boardroom or wherever you are, we always try to kind of have everything under control and portray that we have complete control, right? So this is my plan, this is exactly what I'm doing, and then I did it. But that's kind of not possible in a world that's changing so fast, because, you know, it's more like a squiggle rather than a straight line, how we live life, how our CV looks like, even if we pretend it's all step by step. And one of the kind of hopes with this work really is to say, let's give people a vocabulary so that actually serendipity is not just something that was about losing control and not being able to plan everything out, but rather, no, you cultivated a mindset and a culture, a corporate culture or else, that made it possible that could happen. I think that's where it gets really exciting, because then we don't have to lie to each other in terms of, yes, like, this is exactly what I wanted to do. Nobody believes you that anyways, right? Nobody believes the CEO to say that they planned everything and knew everything. But actually, you can develop a much deeper connection with people by saying, this is what we planned, and then this happened, and then we did this with it, and that's fine, because that's the new type of leadership skill that we need. And I think when we legitimize that, then I think we all can connect on a much deeper level, because we realize we are all fallible, we're all fragile, we're all just human beings. And after the third glass of red wine, every CEO will tell you that they, you know, have no idea what they're doing. And so it's kind of, you know, I think that's the beautiful thing also. At the moment, there's a lot of really bad things at the moment, but also I think it shows that nobody has it all figured out.
Yeah. Christian, at the end of every chapter, you've got good sort of things to do, practical things to do to increase your serendipity. Just give us a few, because there's too many to go through. I mean, you've got like 15 at the end of every chapter. If someone's listening to this, they're going, I feel like I'm quite an unlucky person, I want to change that. Give them some idea. I mean, I imagine they should get the book and read it, but give them some ideas of some of the things that you think would change a mindset and change their luck.
Yeah, Well, I'm a big fan of small steps, right? It's we all talk about innovation and change all the time, but then nobody really, you know, is a big fan of it, including myself. Like, I grew up in Germany. Like, I love planning. I love having, like, rituals and routines, and that's it, right? And so this is really not about saying, oh, my God, like, change your whole life. This is about saying, make small changes. For example, you know, change the way you ask questions. Instead of asking the what do you do question, why not ask something, you know, what is it that you enjoy doing? Or what is it that, you know, you find most interesting about XYZ thing? Because what happens when you ask questions that way is, imagine you go to a fishing village in Italy and you ask a fisherwoman the what do you do question. She would say, I'm a fisherwoman, and you're a TV moderator, and you might say, well, there's not much we have in common, right? Versus if you ask her, what is it that you enjoy doing, or why do you enjoy fishing at the moment, whatever it is, she might say, well, I love the endlessness of the sea. And you might say, oh my God, that's why I love reading XYZ thing. And so that's when you find these unexpected overlaps, when you ask people a little bit more about what's underlying something without pushing it on them, really kind of very in a non-obtrusive way. A second one really, and I think the one I mentioned earlier, to me is one of the most effective ones, the hook strategy, because that's really about saying, if I write down two or three things I'm excited about, you know, in my case, for example, when I come late to a meeting or something, I would say something like, I'm so sorry, I was just thinking about how to get the serendipity mindset into education and company organizations, but now I'm here. And so I'm trying to cast a hook where I'm like, something where people might be like, oh my God, such a coincidence, my sister's running a school, you should come by, and you name it, right? So it's really about saying, let's build those small hooks into every conversation, not only the conversation with a new person, but also with a colleague who might not even know that we're looking for something. And then from the most unexpected of places, right? Your aunt's friend might recently have exactly that like opportunity that you're looking for. And really kind of casting those hooks can help us do that. But then I think, Tim, to the third and last point, really, as you mentioned, there's so many practices and strategies we can all use. But I think at the absolute core is to really think about what is holding me back from having more of it. And really reflecting on incidences in our life where serendipity could have happened, but it didn't, right? Those unexpected ideas in a meeting that we didn't talk about because we felt X, Y, Z thing. And then really working on those kind of deeper underlying themes, because the practices are easy to take on. But I think the bigger question is, how do we overcome things like fear of rejection and so on? And I think that's a lot about reframing and tackling things.
And just
on.
Finally, you've mentioned a couple of times about serendipity journaling. What does that mean? How do you do that?
It's really just about, you know, taking like a diary type booklet and just kind of really putting down, okay, what is something at the moment that I'm interested in? So the kind of key themes. We talked about some examples there. If you're a student who's just graduating, it might be, I'm interested in a career in banking, right? So that's just a kind of broader interest. But then, like, that is something that you can turn into a hook, right? So you would literally write down, oh, like, okay, in every conversation now, I'll refer to that, you know, hey, banking is interesting. If you know something, let me know, whatever it is. But also then really kind of writing down a little bit more, like, what are action steps? And I think that's where it gets really interesting, right? So what are three things you will do tomorrow to actually have more of that happen? And then as you go, you reflect on this, right? So the it's literally like a diary then, that every day you reflect a little bit. What was it today where serendipity happened? What was it about what I did? But also where could it happen and it didn't? And really kind of treating it like a diary. It's really kind of not a too structured kind of way of this is five things, but it's really more about constantly reflecting on the serendipity. And what's fascinating is that the more you have serendipity happen after and after, it's multiplying. And it's fascinating to see that kind of step shift. And I will never forget, you know, a colleague of mine in London, when I started with his work, he was like, Christian, I love you. I love your work, but I don't think I need more serendipity in my life. Like, I'm happy. I have my position. I have my family and everything else. And we made a deal and we said, you know what? Just do a couple of these things differently and let's see what happens. He comes back after a few weeks and he's like, Christian, I didn't know life can be so joyful. And I think to me, this is really at the core of a lot of this, to say, hey, this is not about changing everything. This is not about, you know, trying to preach to someone. You have to have this mindset from today to tomorrow. No, it's about a couple of things you can do differently, and then after and after, you will find that joy and that meaning in it. And that comes to our earlier point. I think we live in a world that's very distressed, that's highly stressful and anxiety enhancing to a lot of people. And if this work can be part of reshaping that a little bit, then I think that's what we've been trying to do with
Absolutely it. Love it. Thank you so much for joining me, Christian. Your book's called Connect the Dots. There's loads of examples here in the book of research and examples of luck and serendipity, and also there's myriad ways that you can enhance your life and examples of what you can do. Thank you so much for joining me, Christian. It was really lovely to chat to you.
Thank you so much for having me.